I think the problem is that we misunderstand what confidence actually is. Confidence is a lag indicator. It's the prize that you win at the end, right? The lead indicator is commitment and courage. So when you, it's like, you know what, I'm going to wait to do that race until I get the gold medal and then I'll do the race. It makes zero sense. You have to do the race in order to have a hope of winning the gold medal. So confidence to me is the prize. It is the sense of, I can do this. You know, I can do this.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass, these are the themes we are exploring. My guest today, Eleanor Beaton, is a fellow Canadian and passionate supporter of women as entrepreneurs. We had an amazing conversation delving into the nuances of radical conviction, confidence, and the attitude and mindset that are required for women to take their businesses and their leadership to the next level. It is a timely conversation that is going to challenge you to get outside your box and outside your comfort zone. It is truly my pleasure to introduce you to Eleanor Beaton. Eleanor Beaton, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
It's so great to be here and to speak with you directly.
Well, I'm excited, right? We were just saying that before we jumped in, that we have these, our circles are like a Venn diagram. We've got this sort of overlap in the middle, and it really is delightful to finally have an opportunity to unpack some of your brilliance as it pertains to women and leadership and business. And I think the opportunities that are sitting right in front of us right now. And as we get into that, Eleanor, I would love, as we get started, for you to just share with my listeners and my community a little bit about you. What brought you to this place in your career where you're at today?
When I was a teenager, you know, I grew up in a household. We immigrated to Canada from the United Kingdom. I'm a biracial woman. My mother, she stayed at home and raised us while my dad brought home the bacon. And I can remember she was driving me to a basketball practice. And she and my father had gotten into an argument about money. And she was very frustrated because she did not make her own money. And she felt that in that moment, she felt very disempowered. And she turned to me, and I can remember she's driving a Dodge minivan. She's gripping the steering wheel. And she turns to me and she says, Eleanor, money is power. Always make your own. And it really inspired in me this desire for financial independence. And, you know, to claim financial independence, I believe in today's world, entrepreneurship is the best path for women. And so that experience and that sort of fire to claim financial independence and to support other women to claim financial independence, that's really the heart of why I do the work that I do today.
I appreciate that story and that personal piece, because I find when we have that why behind what we do, it just fuels everything in an entirely different way. And I love how you frame this right out of the get-go. Like, we're not beating it around the bush here. We're talking about two really critical elements that I find as women, we kind of dance around but don't want to name. And that is financial autonomy. You said financial independence and power. Mm-hmm. I feel like those are two things right off the bat. We have a whole cohort of people, I was going to say, who are driving to work, but no one's driving to work right now, who are listening to this podcast. We're like, oh, I don't want that. I mean, I don't need lots of money, and oh, I don't need power. That's not what this is. I've had this conversation a few times with women this week. Can we just start there and unpack that a little bit? Why is that so triggering in your opinion for women?
Oh, that's such a good question. Because historically, we have been raised in a culture that, while, you know, on one level this is changing, on another level it takes time to develop past millennia of conditioning, right? And so for many, many, many years in our culture, a woman is somebody who is provided for by her father, by her partner, you know. And so this idea of getting it for ourselves and of having that kind of financial independence, while we may have been raised to want those things, sort of, there's still a lot of conditioning that nice, you know, it's okay to, you know, do well in school, to go to university, to start a business. But the idea of explicitly, like having explicit ambition around these things, I think is still tenuous for many women. So I think there's a lot of conditioning that goes into that. And I have certainly seen it. You know, it's so interesting. There's this undertone in so much of the women's empowerment movement, which is that it's okay for us as women to do what we do in order to make the world a better place. It's not okay for us to do what we do because we want to have financial resources. And I personally would argue that you can have impact no matter where you are in the world, but when you are financially resourced, you have tremendous power to create and drive change if you want to.
Yeah, I love that you say that. And I feel like opening that up and settling into that realization is just part of that growth that we experience as entrepreneurs. And when you sit in a room where you're like, wow, I do have power and a voice here because I have the credibility of having created that independence and that foundation and that sustainability in my business. It's a different conversation that you have access to. It's a different capacity for impact that you have access to. Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I forget, you know, and sometimes I forget because there was a time, you know, as I was developing my voice as a leader and my voice as an entrepreneur and so on, where I felt that I needed permission. And I know we're going to talk about confidence here in a moment. You know, it's kind of the vein that runs through everything we're talking about here. But there was a time when I felt that I needed permission from other people to be able to speak about ambition, to be able to speak about the desire to have financial independence. And now, you know, I've come to this place where I've had so many conversations with women who about how refreshing it is to speak very openly about money and power, that I think for me and someone like you, just kind of having those conversations, talking about the desire, you know, to be able to have wealth and to use it in a way that that shapes the world in a way that we want to see it. To me, being that example is so powerful, I think.
Well, and you're bang on there when you talk about this notion of permission, because, and I'm sure you have this experience in the women that you work with as well, it's the number one thing everyone cites. They're like, well, like once we get down to the core of it, they're like, well, I was kind of waiting for, you know, my father or my boss or like somebody be like, okay, it's your turn now. Like here you go. We're all cheering you on at the starting line. But it's that's just not how it works. Like the permission's on the shelf. You grab it. You have to go up and grab it.
You have to take it. You know, a couple of years ago, this was so funny. I was with my kids at this like Thanksgiving race. It was a Thanksgiving fun race. And so the girls would line up to race and then they'd get started and then the boys would line up to race. And it was so funny because I was watching the girls and they were all at the line, you know, so there'd be like 100 girls and they were all, not one of them was stepping over the line. The boys are at the line, but they're not at the line. They keep moving past the line. By the time the race started, the guys in the front, these like 8-year-old boys, were 10 feet in front of the line. And so it's interesting how whatever we're doing culturally is showing up from a really, really young age. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that the girls were like, look, here's the line. Let's be legit and real here. Let's just make it fair and we're going to wait at the line. So I don't want to make us wrong. You know what I mean?
Like,
Yeah. But you could see it already, this the difference in attitude between what we're allowed and not allowed to do.
It's so true. And it's funny because I had a psychotherapist on the show, oh gosh, let's say 40 episodes ago. And we were just talking about growth, and we were talking about sort of stages of independence. And she just mentioned, she was like, well, what happens is you reach a point in life where you transfer authority from your parents. And my subconscious brain filled in the blank. It was like, to your husband. And then she was like, to yourself. And I caught that it interrupted my pattern, because there's no part of my conscious belief that's like, oh, I transferred all my authority over to my husband. Anyone who knows my husband and I is like, yeah, that's not the case.
They're like, no.
But I stopped the interview and I said to her, like, okay, let's unpack where my brain just went with this. I think we talked about it openly, but I was like, wow, like that was deep in my cells of subconscious that I filled in that blank that way. But if I'm doing that, and I've been deeply conditioned to sort of respect the autonomy of women and us as individuals, I'm like, I can't even imagine if you hadn't been exposed to those conversations. Right? What's happening to you at that moment of coming to age? Like it was a very eye-opening experience for me.
Well, you know what's so interesting, and I love this conversation because I suspect so many women can relate to it. Like, we are independent women. We have been raised by, in many cases, by people who encourage that inside us. And yet we're still a part of a culture. We're part of a culture that still has an ambivalent relationship with powerful women. It's so interesting. Like, when you look at, like, let's take, you know, classical antiquity, which is, you know, Roman and Greek culture, a huge source of inspiration, of stories, of literary allusions, like that we all, that if you grew up, you know, in North America or in Western culture, let's say, that culture very much has shaped how, you know, our upbringing or our stories or, you know, a lot of how we've grown up in this culture, let's say. So what's so interesting about that, take somebody like Medusa, you know, the head of snakes, in order to, you know, step into his power, Perseus had to behead Medusa. What's so interesting is when you look at most powerful women political leaders, they have classically, there are so, like, thousands of cartoons that depict them as Medusas. So there is a deeply ambivalent relationship that our culture has with powerful women. We're not sure how we feel about powerful women. And there are so many instances in culture of arts, you know, and legends where powerful women have been beheaded, had their tongues cut out. I mean, this sounds so visceral. I know people are like, oh my God, I'm trying to have my lovely morning tea. But let's just go for it here, Megan.
If you watch CNN, you can handle this conversation.
So this is what we're trying to, of course, this is not something that shapes us every single day. But there's a resonance, right? There's still a hangover, a mild hangover in our culture of looking at women this way. And I think that's when we're looking for permission. This is partly the soup that we're swimming in.
Yeah, I totally agree. And when we have other people in positions of leadership, I'm not going to call them leaders, who refer to powerful women as nasty and use derogatory language, it continues to set us back. It continues to reinforce that subconscious message that I referred to. And it makes it that much more difficult. I find sometimes even myself, and I don't know about you, maybe you've evolved past this, I overthink my interactions. So I'm like, oh, you know, if I act this way, then I'm going to be perceived as a bitch. And if I don't act this way, then I'm going to be perceived as soft. And I catch myself being stuck in my head about how I navigate my behavior at times, because I do feel like there are so many other layers to how we interpret women doing powerful work. Do you get caught up in that sometimes?
I do. And you know what's so interesting is, and I was thinking about this as you were sharing your experience, I don't know if you've noticed this. So for me, the sphere in which that has happened has changed. So I'll give you an example. So when I started blogging, I started my very first blog in 2013. And it was before that I had very much been behind the scenes. But, you know, for a woman to publicly share her ideas is a radical act, you know? And so I started blogging, and I can remember feeling so afraid of judgment and criticism anytime I wrote something that had any sort of bold opinion or strong wording. I had, you know, what Brené Brown would call like a vulnerability hangover. I felt like I'd overstepped. I felt like I was coming across as aggressive, yada, yada. So in the beginning, my fears and my insecurity were really related to nameless, faceless masses, even though there were like 20 people who were reading my blog at that stage. But you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, I do.
As I have developed and grown, what's so interesting is that circle has gotten a lot smaller. So now what the masses and you know, what nameless, faceless people would think isn't really an issue anymore. But for me, where I start to question myself is, say, with my team.
Right.
So it's like, hey, did I, you know, so I just really laid down my expectations very clearly just now. Was that too much? Yeah. You know, so it starts to, that completely happens to me. And the sort of sphere in which that happens, ironically, gets smaller and smaller, where it's more of those sort of closer relationships, especially leadership type relationships, where you're leading people and managing people. That's where I've noticed it coming into play more and more.
Well, and I think too, as you become more and more conscious of the power of the people that you put around you, it enables you to accelerate past that place where you are stuck in your head. Because your cohort and your colleagues are all managing the same things, but they're all working to evolve past it. They're all moving in the same direction. It's interesting because I find that I'm at this phase of life where the cover of all the journals at the bookstore are starting to make sense. Like the quotes that they're using and these old adages that you've heard this whole time, you're like, yeah, I get it. You're like, no, I get it now. I feel it now. Like my circle matters. Like I now viscerally understand what that looks like. And all of that, in my experience, really starts to fuel and accelerate one of the things I really want to talk about today, which is confidence. And how do we cultivate confidence? Because similar to the permission to step into a state of ambition and financial independence, I also feel like we're waiting for confidence to arrive in a package on our front door. They're like, well, once I'm confident, I'm ready to go. Once I have that wardrobe, I'm ready to go. It's an acquisition that we get all at once, as opposed to something that we earn. Can we start to unpack this notion of confidence? Because I know this is something that you are incredibly passionate about.
Well, I think the problem is that we misunderstand what confidence actually is. Confidence is a lag indicator. It's the prize that you win at the end, right? The lead indicator is commitment and courage. So when it's like, you know what? I'm going to wait to do that race until I get the gold medal, and then I'll do the race. It makes zero sense. You have to do the race in order to have a hope of winning the gold medal. So confidence to me is the prize. It is the sense of, I can do this. You know, I can do this. And how do we know we can do this? Generally, because we have done it, because we have tried, right?
Right.
So before, what precedes confidence is, number one, commitment, like the willingness to bet on yourself, the willingness to try, the willingness to fail, the willingness to, for women, I find this can be crippling for women, the willingness to be seen to fail publicly, right? Because there's so much pressure on us to be perfect. So I think, you know, once I realized that confidence doesn't feel like the path to getting confidence. We think that we feel, you know, we feel engaged, we feel on it, we feel totally competent. That's what happens at the end of the path, right? At the beginning of the path, you feel like a hot mess. You're kind of sweating. You're not sure if you can do it, but you're filled with hope. And also you're filled with a commitment to at least try. So I think once we understand that confidence is a lag indicator, the lead indicator, the thing that you do first is commit and have courage. I think that fundamentally transforms our relationship with confidence. And so for me, it's really about creating environments where women feel supported to try, where women feel supported to fail, and where women have the support to publicly fail and feel humiliated and keep going. Because that's important too.
What does that environment look like?
To me, it looks like having other people who are in the ring with you and listening to their voices and their voices alone. That's it. You know, I mean, I think that, and it's really starting to edit down who you listen to, and whose opinion matters to you, and who you allow to shape what steps you take, and who just doesn't have a seat on the jury.
Cue the mastermind culture.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most powerful work that I've done personally and professionally is, like I said, surround myself with a group of people who are all equally committed. Mm-hmm. To that next level. Eleanor, how do you feel about the term fake it till you make it?
It's so interesting. There's something about that feels inauthentic in the sense that, so when people say fake it till you make it, I get what they're saying. I think what they're, you know, for me, the way that I get my head around that is, did Steve Jobs know that he could make a dent in the universe? Was he certain that he could do it when he said he wanted to do it? No, but he had faith in himself, you know? So he was sort of faking it till he made it. He didn't have 100% proof, evidence, concrete confirmation that he was going to be able to get to the promised land he was trying to get to, but he had confidence in his willingness to try. Where I sometimes run into problems with it is in the sense that, you know, when people start to talk about faking it till it's like the people who, it's people who use that as a license to give advice, to claim expertise in an area where they're really not qualified to do it.
Right, which is the imposter syndrome, which is all of those pieces.
And I mean, some people I wish would have more imposter syndrome. I'm going to be honest. Some people I'm like, oh, you need a little imposter syndrome. You need to like get your fundamentals in place.
Yes.
Be first, right? Like some political leaders, for instance, you kind of wish they had some imposter syndrome.
But we won't mention any names.
I know. We won't mention names. The people who often suffer the most from imposter syndrome are the people who typically least need to have it. So the people who are, you know what I'm saying?
Totally.
That's yeah.
And when you talk about this notion of courage, like making this commitment and then having the courage to step into the ring, I feel like for some people that's the leap, right? Yeah. Is like, oh, but where? I thought it was confidence that I needed, but you're right. It's courage, new word. Where do I get that? Like, how does that tie in to this concept that you talk about, which is radical conviction?
Mm-hmm. You know, it starts with your vision. It really, really starts with your vision. And I think, you know, when it comes to cultivating courage, courage is like this glorious state between that's bookended by two things. On the one hand, it's bookended by the vision of where you want to be and where you want to go. And taking time, you know, I think it's so important for women to take time every day to just quietly envision their vision, to give ourselves permission to have the time and space and understand that maybe the most important work you do today is taking 5 minutes to imagine and see where you will be 5 years from now in as vivid detail possible. And so, and that is a muscle, like the vision muscle is a muscle, but allowing that to exist and that, that vision becomes so compelling that it becomes this thing that draws you toward it, you know? And I think that's at one bookend. And the other bookend is the, is like a gritty why. It's the real reason. And this is so interesting. As I started working with women, particularly the women that I work with in my business. And so these are women, they're fabulous. They're typically fairly well educated. They have, they sometimes they're self-made. Sometimes they came from, you know, an affluent family or a middle-class family, but they're in a position right now of privilege and comfort. And in some cases, that privilege and comfort, the thing that you have to overcome in order to have courage to go for the things that you want is this comfort, is a willingness to step away from the comfort. So we start to lose touch with our gritty why. And I started to see this as I looked at some of the most successful entrepreneurs I knew, some of the grittiest entrepreneurs I knew who overcame significant adversity, you know, growing up. And mm-hmm. so they had a gritty why. I will never go back to handouts and, you know, poverty. So for many of the people who are listening, you don't have that experience necessarily. So it becomes really important to understand, number on the one end, what's your vision? But on the other hand, why does this really matter to you? And for me, I'm business partners with my husband, but our business is like, I'm the founder and CEO of it. And it, for me, the gritty why is really having a financial fortress for my family. So if something happened to me tomorrow, they're going to be okay. So sometimes I dust that one off when I need some extra courage.
I love that idea of a financial fortress.
Right?
Yeah.
Who doesn't want that? It's like, it's just fun.
Well, and it's also powerful language.
Mm-hmm.
And the language piece matters. And I came across a website of someone who's doing really awesome work. Well, she's been on your podcast, Allie Brown. And mm-hmm. I was looking at some of her her programming, and she was really explicit. She was like, this program is not for women who are questioning their why, or who are experiencing self-doubt, or need someone to hold their hand to go to the next level. Like, this is for women who are totally confident where they need to go. They require some clarity. Like, the language was so much more powerful. It was mm-hmm. next level. The power of the language excluded an entire cohort of individuals. And I appreciated it so much, because mm-hmm. it required that you sort of broaden your shoulders and step into the room in a different way. So I appreciate your language in the same respect, because it really does compel you, and frankly gives you permission to step into that right. next room. Right? Because the conversation's happening. There's lovely, incredible women in that next room over talking about powerful things and not apologizing for it.
No. No.
Where does the apology fit into this? Our need to apologize. I find when we consistently get caught in a pattern of saying sorry, we are consistently taking this step back. Do you find that there are elements of language or things that we are doing as women that just kind of keep setting us back? Are there patterns that you love to interrupt that way?
Yeah. And I mean, there are patterns that I have worked and continue to work really hard to root out of my own language. And so there are things like, sorry is one, apologizing. And there's a great Amy Schumer skit about apologizing. It's great. Just put Amy Schumer apology in Google.
I'm already laughing.
Check it out. Right? It's amazing. But it's this idea of sort of making ourselves smaller, making our ideas smaller. So things like this, saying something and then saying, does this make sense?
I say that all the time.
Right?
Keep going.
And I do too. And I have to stop myself. Of course it makes sense. We're clear communicators. What we're really trying to say there is, do you hear me? Are you connecting with what I have just shared with you? What we're looking for there is the bond, the connection, that moment where you can tell someone is truly picking up what you're putting down. it's not, the question isn't, are we making sense? The question is, are you picking up what I'm putting down? It's really important that we're together on this before I move on, you know, to the next brilliant thing I was going to say. So that's an example where we have, there is sort of a conditioning to somewhat demean ourselves in order to, you know, in order to provide support, you know, to somebody else. And so I think these are the kinds of things that they're just these little, they're little hangovers. They're little reactions, they're reflexes. But those reflexes over time create an environment that in which, you know, we may be or we could be potentially making ourselves a little bit smaller than we need to. So that's an example. You know, that's an example of how language and how the way that we communicate can shape our reality.
Yeah, I did a podcast a little while ago talking about the word just. Oh, and how, yeah, I worked so hard to remove it from my vocabulary, because it was this, I would reread things. I was like, whoa, I just demeaned my idea. Whoa, I'm just minimizing what, whoa, I'm trying to make them feel comfortable, as opposed to, like, it is a word that I have abolished from my vocabulary as much as I can. But to me, that's the example, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Eleanor, talk to me a little bit about the women that you work with and the process that you you take them through. I mean, you talk about right on your website, it took one type of confidence to get you where you are today, and the next chapter will require a whole new level of self-belief. And I use this analogy that, you know, we come into the train station on one train, but the next level of our career and life often requires that we get off and move, yeah, on to a new vehicle. So it completely conjured that idea. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about who you work with and what kind of process you take them through so that they're hitting that next frontier of their career and of their life.
The women that I am working with, you know, I call them SAFIs, self-actualized female innovators. And so these are women who, right? Just they're the women who'll change the world. And so these are typically women who have been successful for a long time and now are craving impact, significance. So I'll give you an example. You know, the sort of classic classic woman in my community is a woman who probably has an advanced degree of some sort, who is excellent at taking a look at the path, understanding the path, walking the path, getting to the summit. You know, so very often they've had, you know, successful business careers. They've been successful for some time. Maybe they have been an executive or a vice president or a director inside some kind of corporate organization potentially. And now they are looking to, for so many women, we get to the pinnacle and then we're like, is this it? Really? Like I have so much more. And that's typical. Those are my people, right? And so at that point, it's really all about impact. And many of them understand and see that their impact has to happen. The only way that they're going to be fulfilled is for that impact to happen inside the container of entrepreneurship, right? So entrepreneurship has been such a fantastic development for feminism, you know, worldwide. But anyway, so now you go from being kind of a mistress of a domain, a master of a domain, and now you are moving into the messiness of entrepreneurship, where it is all about trying things, iterating, moving quickly, articulating your vision. There are not, you know, lengthy corporate leadership development and mentoring programs so that you can, you know, bring people up. You have to be fast. You have to be explicit in what you expect. You need to be compassionate yet exacting all at the same time. So the work that I do with those women in some cases is very tactical around putting in place sort of structures in their business, but there's this other side of it, which is very much about becoming. So becoming the woman leader that in many cases they started their business as a way to become all along.
I love that. And you said something in there, you said entrepreneurship as a vehicle for feminism. And I just stopped there for 1 second because I was like, yes, I have believed this and talked about this for so long. But the place I'm usually talking about it is in a mastermind, which is predominantly men. And they just look at you and they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah,
like moving on. I remember I was at one event and we got to each put in a thing we wanted to talk about and explore and see how we could leverage the room. And I was like, I want to talk about entrepreneurship as a way to support women as like the ultimate empowerment tool. And everyone's like, yeah, I don't see what you mean. I was like, okay, this is so interesting because it was so obvious to me.
Right?
So it's been a long time since I've heard somebody else like really be able to explicitly articulate and recognize that connection, because I think it is such a powerful tool available to us.
Well, you know, and we're seeing, I mean, as we're recording this interview, we are seeing major social upheaval and civil unrest as we as a society are questioning entrenched structures and entrenched hierarchies. And I think that the corporate world is a hierarchy. And it's interesting, you know, that you're talking about like privilege is the great, you know, the byproduct of privilege is not having a clue about how the other half lives.
Right.
You know, so for us, we completely get how entrepreneurship is a vehicle for feminism, for people who have been privileged not to have to find their way outside of regular structures in order to be able to really bring their fullness, you know, the fullness of who they are into being. I mean, if you think about it right now, they're calling the global recession, they're calling it a she-cession because of its disproportionate mm-hmm. impact on women. Those women are women who are working inside corporate structures who, you know, we're seeing who have not had the flexibility and freedom in many cases to deal with disproportionate household load.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Absolutely.
So,
yep.
Yeah. It's just juicy. It's just, I mean, I'm with you on entrepreneurship and, you know, as a vehicle for feminism. And the other interesting thing that I see, and I'm not sure, you know, if this would be a super fun conversation for us to have another time, but it's all, you know, it's this idea that so much of how we talk about entrepreneurship is still not geared for women.
Unpack that a little bit.
So a lot of times I have found that in many forms of entrepreneurship education, it's all about the doing, it's all about the tactics, and it's all about the strategy. And for women, when we are taking risks, it is as much about who we need to be to take those risks. And so you will frequently hear women talking about, on, you know, the biggest prize of entrepreneurship is who you become. We rarely hear men talking about that because it isn't as big of a deal. Just not as big of a deal to them. For us, it is a huge deal, you know, how we develop as humans as we create something out of nothing, which is what entrepreneurship truly is.
Yeah, it's so very true. And as I'm evolving into the next phase of my career, one of the things I oscillated between was, you know, do I just focus on women and entrepreneurship, or do I broaden and incorporate men? My practice when I was practicing was really, it was a 50-50 split. I enjoy mm-hmm. working with men, but I was like, darn it, like the next frontier of where I go is really about how we support women, how we penetrate women into more positions of leadership, how we give them more platforms for their voice, because I feel like now more than ever, it's our voices that the world needs.
Well, it's interesting. The World Economic Forum released a report a couple of weeks ago that took a look at 139 countries around the world and statistically significantly and, you know, basically across the board, women-led countries, Germany, New Zealand, you know, recovered much faster from COVID and the, you know, the resulting shutdowns than countries that were led by men. Women make fantastic leaders, especially during times of crisis and adversity. I agree with you wholeheartedly. This is the next frontier. And it doesn't mean that we're better leaders than men, but it means that there's something, especially, you know, when we look at what our world is experiencing now, this is a powerful time for us.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you say that, because it isn't, it isn't about being better. It's not that entrepreneurs are better than people in a corporate context, and men are better than women. Like I think part of our problem that we are seeing geopolitically is this black and white need to segment everyone into an either or category. And we need some gray with some splashes of pink and this real opportunity to understand that there's different people for different jobs, but we have a different way of leading. I think we're seeing that in our own country right now. And as you mentioned, around the world. As an ND and anthropologist, I have always been on the lookout for unique insights into my own health. While I have gadgets and trackers, nothing has provided me with the kind of actionable information I needed, like lifestyle genetic testing. DNA Labs is a lifestyle genetics testing company based in Toronto, Canada. Lifestyle genetics offers insight into the relationship between your genes and the lifestyle choices you have access to every day. The frontier of health is precision medicine. Informing yourself and your practitioner about your genetic blueprint provides personalized insight unattainable through any other sort of testing. Whether it is understanding how to reduce your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, or depression, selecting the most efficacious medications, or reducing side effects to those medications, or even designing a lifestyle plan and health optimization protocol that harnesses your unique potential, this is the mission of DNA Labs. Acquiring samples are as simple as a cheek swab and can be completed in the privacy of your own home. For public listeners in Canada and the U.S., until July 30th, you can receive a 15% discount for online orders when you enter Anthropology2020 at dnalabs.ca. For practitioners, you can access a pro panel and practitioner pricing by sending a message to contact@dnalabs.ca. Eleanor, we could have this conversation all day long, but I think that this is a perfect place to transition into a series of questions that I call our KPIs. So just like we have key performance indicators in our business, I believe that we have them in how we live our lives as well. So if you'll indulge me, I've got some rapid fire questions for you.
Let's do it.
What is the most impactful book you have read during the pandemic?
Kindred. It's a novel by the great science fiction writer Octavia Butler.
I love it when we pull in science fiction or fiction in general with entrepreneurs. So, okay, great. I'm going to check that out. What's the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
Meditation.
I'm not surprised. What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
I am a really excellent juggler.
Oh, okay. Legit. I love that. I'm just going to take a break once. We had somebody on the podcast once. I asked this question. He's like, oh, yeah, I really like to mountain bike. And I was like, that's cool. He's like, on my unicycle. And I was like, what? Mic drop. So that's awesome. I love the juggling. I'll soon have like a full circus that I can pull together.
Yeah, totally.
What do you do for fun or play?
I read.
Fair. And last question for you, Eleanor. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
We learn.
I love it. Eleanor Beaton, it has been an absolute pleasure. Where can I send people to learn a little bit more about what you're up to?
If you like podcasts, you should check out the Power Presence Position Show, which is my podcast.
Amazing. We'll hook everyone up in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I am still totally jazzed about finding someone else who believes that entrepreneurship is this incredible opportunity to drive feminism forward, to help more women in challenging situations. These types of conversations and ideas are the sort of things that I love to talk about in the Anthropology Collective. If you haven't joined us in our free Facebook group yet, I would encourage you to come and hang out with us. And I'd love for you to just think further on this idea. How can we all contribute to elevating and moving women forward through the idea and principles of entrepreneurship, heightened states of leadership, and stepping into courage, the ring, and acquiring the confidence that we need to lend our leadership to the world. I thoroughly enjoyed having Eleanor on the podcast today. We have so many incredible women just like her coming up in the next few weeks. Join us here again next Tuesday as we delve into another juicy topic about taking your business, body, and inner badass to a whole new level. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker, and I will see you again next week.